18 to number 6. Thank you also for your help. Deion Strong versus David Alphonson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Lovey. I'm arguing on behalf of the appellant, Deion Strong. Deion Strong alleges that 5 years ago, 5 years this summer, he was sexually assaulted by a prison doctor. No less than any other American, he has the right to pursue his claim for constitutional grievances in this federal forum. Notwithstanding that Mr. Strong did everything that was required of him under the PLRA and timely filed a federal lawsuit, he has been denied that opportunity to seek redress from the court system.
Could I clarify one thing about this case?
Sure.
At one point, it looked to me like he might have been seeking or might have received restoration of good time credits. Is there any durational aspect to this case, or did that drop out of the case?
It's my understanding that it has dropped out, Your Honor. What is being sought now is indeed a compensation for sexual assault and for the subsequent cover-up. It is plaintiff's position that summary judgment by the district court could be reversed.
What would compensation be for the, what you're calling the cover-up, and what the defendants would describe as simply a denial of liability?
Well, we are construing it, and of course...
Right, if a tort is committed, you don't get extra compensation just because you have to sue the other side in order to recover for the tort.
Your Honor, what we've pled here, although it admittedly has been pled in a pro se way, is a constitutional conspiracy, a Section 1983 conspiracy, which caused the injuries in question. What is going to be pled and has been pled, if you're going to give the prisoner liberal interpretation of its pleading, is an agreement on the part of the prison defendant to conspire to prevent investigation and prevent Mr. Strong from pursuing redress. And in that sense, the prison actors have some culpability.
Yeah, I just don't understand what's tortious about that. And if you sue a doctor for malpractice, do you get extra damages if you show that the other doctors really wanted to help the defendant rather than the plaintiff?
Well, what you could do is show other actors are liable. And of course, you know, that is not necessarily...
Well, they might be liable as aiders and abettors or something like that. But that would just be for the damages caused by the malpractice. And here, the damages caused by the sexual assault.
To the extent that that's, you know, part of our...
I don't think anything turns on this appeal. I'm just kind of puzzled by what's being added here.
I think part of the problem is that the only thing we have is a pro se prisoner pleading, because we never got past that stage in the 5 years, because the district court called for the exhaustion issue and then granted summary judgment. And in our view, the issue that is central to this appeal, that decision can't stand on either or both of plaintiff's grievances. And I'll start with the August grievance, because interestingly, the state defendants make no argument in their response brief as to why that grievance doesn't suffice under the PLRA. And I think that as a factual matter, looking at that grievance, it clearly does. The first page puts the prison on notice of the sexual assault. The second page talks about the conspiracy theory, and at the end, he starts using words like cover-up, and he says in his relief, "I want this matter not to be overlooked." Under the case law surrounding the PLRA, that is what is required of exhaustion. The prison administration has to be given the opportunity, if they are so inclined, to do something about the problem. The facts giving rise to the problem have to be brought to their attention. And that's what Mr. Strong has done. This grievance fully apprises the prison administration of the claim. It builds the record. It does everything that exhaustion is supposed to do. And then the prison administration chose to do nothing. If there was any doubt that this grievance sufficed to get him into federal court, Exhibit B to our appendix is a copy of the administration's decision. And the administration characterizes plaintiff's claim for him. They say he's grieving the sexual assault, and they also say explicitly, the inmate states he's also grieving the conduct of the entire staff at Shawnee who had knowledge of the incident. The panel finds that on review of all the available information, that his grievance regarding the entire staff who had knowledge is inappropriate and recommends no further action. That's certainly the prison's prerogative. But now, plaintiff, like all other people in this country, has a right to take it to federal court. Section 1983 was enacted for the very purpose of providing a federal cause of action when your constitutional rights are violated.
Well, that's something of an overstatement about 1983, given the federal court's view until the mid-70s, the prisoners had no complaint at all. But again, nothing turns on that here.
And, Your Honor,
I wouldn't be disputing that 1983 is there today, counsel, just so you know.
Well, I think that PLRA creates an exception, and I think that the case law we've cited hasn't been rebutted, and that is exceptions are to be construed narrowly. And
you mean the exhaustion requirement of the PLRA?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The exhaustion requirement being an exception to the right to pursue a Section 1983 claim. And I think the first grievance unquestionably qualified.
That narrow construction argument didn't survive Booth against Turner, did it? Booth against Turner actually helps you more than it hurts you, but whatever Booth did, it didn't construe the exhaustion requirement narrowly.
I think we can see that point and still prevail today. And I think
Well, it depends what you mean by narrowly. You certainly have to exhaust. Booth against Turner says exhaustion means exhaustion. We don't care, as you argued in your brief, what relief might or might be forthcoming. But I thought your point was that the, as it were, the notice requirement in the prison grievance wasn't some requirement that's significantly stricter than what we would think of for a Rule 8 complaint, for example, that prisoners need to give fair notice, but they don't need to give chapter, book, and verse.
I think that's mm-hmm. Plaintiff's point exactly, and well said. And I think Booth does support our position. The district court hung its hat on the argument that, well, the prisoner didn't seek the same relief he's seeking in federal court, and leaving aside how counterintuitive that argument is, because you know, that's like saying that he had to demand a jury trial and the right to damages when there's been no showing that he could have gotten damages from the prison system. Even leaving that aside, Booth lays to rest all questions about whether the relief you are seeking is the prerequisite. And frankly, the district court's analysis in that regard no longer survives Booth. And the August grievance in and of itself warrants reversal of the district court's decision. Now, if there was any doubt, you have the December grievance. And the state defendant's current counsel has pointed out that grievance has been fully exhausted. And plaintiff did what plaintiff could at the district court level to ascertain the exhaustion status of this grievance. Discovery was frozen by the district court.
You said this in your reply brief, but why was discovery important? Surely the plaintiff himself knew what he did.
Well,
he didn't need discovery to find out what he did.
Plaintiff was in jail, didn't have the documents necessary to give to his counsel. What counsel did on appeal was she conferred with the client.
He could easily have filed an affidavit saying, here's what I did.
As appellate counsel conceded, she, in order to determine the exhaustion status, had to confer with her client as well, to the extent that there's some ambiguity. She had the benefit of talking with an employee of the IDOC before arriving at this conclusion. Because I couldn't depose that same employee, I didn't have that benefit. But leaving aside who's to blame about not revealing that this grievance has been exhausted. The fact is now undisputed that the grievance is exhausted, and I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, but I would submit that careful or even cursory review of this grievance reveals that, as even the district court conceded, it is a sufficient predicate under the PLRA to allow plaintiffs to plead a federal cause of action. Thank you,
counsel.
I'm Laura Wonder on behalf of the State Defendants, Your Honors. The State Defendant's brief in this case has undeniably changed the focus of the litigation. The litigation had proceeded in the district court under a premise which we now know to have been mistaken, and we now know that Mr. Strong's December grievance was, in fact, procedurally exhausted. In the district court, no challenge was made to the procedural exhaustion of the August grievance, only to the December grievance. The two grievances are similar. The December grievance essentially says everything the August grievance says and then a bit more. They're similar in many respects. The mistaken premise came to light when, upon review of the record, if you look at the December grievance, and that's contained in the plaintiff's appendix at Exhibit E, among other places, there is a received stamp indicating that it was received by the Office of Inmate Issues. Rather difficult to read, and we now know that the Office of Inmate Issues is an office that, among its other functions, operates the Administrative Review Board. Therefore, the December grievance was, in fact, filed with the Administrative Review Board and was procedurally exhausted.
Who actually physically files these things? Does it go up from the prison, or what role does the prisoner have in getting this along its way?
It's the prisoner's obligation to submit the grievance to the Administrative Review Board, whether he drops it in a mailbox or, you know, there's a certain procedure to do that. I'm not entirely certain. But the prisoner did what he was supposed to do in this case and filed the grievance with the Administrative Review Board, as we have learned. And we apologize to the court that this has come to light on the appeal.
I was actually interested in the argument that we had before, but I guess it really doesn't matter at this point if both of them were exhausted.
Procedurally.
That's what we mean by exhaustion. You presented something. Now, you're making an argument based on the content of this that you somehow had no idea what it is, what incident Mr. Strong was complaining about, based on his either or both of his grievances, which I find very hard to understand, since he certainly lays out the incident and basically says to the prison, do something about it. I'm not sure Booth requires anything more than that. He's not supposed to say, do this, give me my TV back, you know, give me damages, give me, you know, fire the prison doctor, whatever. That's for the prison to decide.
Well, that argument actually does remain, although the focus has shifted from the August grievance to the December grievance. Initially, when the parties had assumed that the December grievance was procedurally defective, what they were litigating was whether the content of the August grievance was sufficient to put prison officials on notice of the claims that were raised in the federal lawsuits and to give them an opportunity to do something about it.
Do you seriously want to argue that this August grievance, which is here at Exhibit C, I guess, of the appendix, isn't enough to put the prison on notice that something seriously wrong is being alleged?
What's being alleged in the amended complaint as to the state defendants is some type of purposeful institutional conspiracy.
Well, but let's back up and talk about Dr. Davis first. Could you read this grievance and not realize that there was an allegation? Nothing's been proven yet, but an allegation that something extraordinarily wrong had been done?
I could perhaps leave that to Dr. David's counsel.
No, but he's in the prison, too. He describes the alleged conduct, and I'm hard put to think that the prison wouldn't have been on notice that by hiring such a doctor, if this alleged conduct took place, something wrong had happened.
With respect to the state defendants, the claims against the state defendants, concerning some type of purposeful cover-up, what the grievance really sets forth, the August grievance and the December grievance, is essentially duplicates the allegations of the August grievance. It's really saying, in essence, it's protesting the discipline imposed on Mr. Strong, saying the admittedly unfavorable polygraph test result was not enough to impose discipline on me and to disbelieve my allegations.
But he also says God will not allow this matter to be covered up in no way, shape, fashion, or form. He certainly does raise the point.
Taken as a whole, though, we would suggest that the grievance is not enough to allow reasonable prison officials to think, hey, there's a cover-up going on here. If you look at the amended complaint, there are several allegations to the effect of Mr. Strong's overhearing the adjustment committee, talking about a whole history of problems with Dr. David, and several allegations of various prison officials pressuring Mr. Strong to recant.
Right.
Now, that information is obviously very relevant to some type of purposeful cover-up.
And it's here in the August. Mr. Stevens told me to my face that he wrote the reissued ticket and that he'd bring the ticket over. I told him he was telling a lie because Captain Kohler served the reissued ticket. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me the way we read pro se complaints in court anyway is liberal enough to cover this.
Nothing in the grievances addresses some type of institutional conspiracy as compared with the allegations of the complaint. And that's really what the court has to decide, what degree of specificity is required here. There's not a lot of case law about specificity. There are a few cases from other circuits which are cited in the brief.
Is there any reason why the degree of specificity here would be greater than that, say, required for a charge of discrimination under the Civil Rights Act of 1964? After that statute was enacted, there was a whole lot of debating about what sufficed for a charge of discrimination. The Supreme Court ultimately held in Love Against Pullman that it could be quite skeletal because it was the kind of document filed by a non-lawyer. Why shouldn't we understand the degree of specificity in a prisoner's grievance in the same way?
Even allowing some liberality for the pro se nature of the grievance.
I'm not asking what do you think Love Against Pullman means. I'm asking whether, in your view, there is a reason why prisoners should be held to a different standard when starting this administrative process than persons claiming to be victims of discrimination are held to. Is there a reason why we should have a difference? And then we can figure out what, if Love applies, what it would do in this case.
The standard should meet the purposes of the exhaustion requirement, which this court has articulated as, at a minimum, putting prison officials on notice of what the problem is and giving them an opportunity to do something about it, which I would suggest...
What a charge of discrimination is supposed to do, too.
I would suggest that translates to a reasonably detailed grievance that is reasonably targeted to the issues in the complaint. And the court needs to see if that is the case here. So alternatively, we would ask the court to affirm the district court on the alternative basis that the content of the December grievance is insufficient, or otherwise to remand to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. 2 minutes, sir. 2 minutes you have, please.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Meadows, and I'm here today on behalf of Dr. David. One thing I would like to state right up front is that when this issue was being litigated with the District Court, we were all operating under the premise that the second grievance filed was never exhausted. One of the reasons that occurred is that the magistrate judge ordered the briefing on that issue, and speaking on behalf of Dr. David, he's not privy to the administrative proceedings nor to any of the documents. So basically, at that time, we, in essence, spoke to the Attorney General's office and were advised he didn't exhaust it, so that's what we proceeded on. We now very recently learned, just in this brief, actually a phone call a few days before the brief, that they are now saying that he did exhaust this particular second grievance. With that said, what we think needs to happen, frankly, in fairness to Judge Murphy, who basically was having to deal with these issues, is for him for it to be remanded back so that he can... so that we can actually do discovery to in fact confirm that what they've indicated is correct, or to see if it's incorrect. We have a sworn affidavit that he didn't exhaust it in the record. We have an unsworn statement in a brief that the plaintiff did in fact exhaust. We don't know, and Dr. David doesn't know, and we're about the only party in this case that has no way of knowing. So what we believe needs to happen is to send back to the judge so that we can determine whether or not it was in fact exhausted, and if it was, then the appeal is moot anyway.
Suppose we focus on the August grievance. Why is that insufficient?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that in reading the Booth case, obviously it approached it from a different point of view. However, we think that what the prisoner needs to do is tell the prison what it is he seeks. What occurs to me in reading the brief is, for example, as Your Honors may be aware, there was some confusion about whether this man failed a polygraph or passed a polygraph. And that that can obviously be resolved at a later date what the real answer was. But, for example, if the Administrative Review Board did in fact grant him the relief that he suggested, which was to be removed from segregation, would he then be allowed to proceed after winning his grievance and seek relief that he never sought with the prison? Now, maybe it wouldn't have made any difference, and in this case maybe it wouldn't have, but the bottom line is if he had prevailed on, with respect to...
Isn't it the central holding of Booth that this exhaustion is not relief-centered? It doesn't even matter whether relief was available in the administrative process.
Well, I think...
Why is it critical that he tell the administrative process what relief precisely was?
I think one of the holdings also in Booth was that the exhaustion requirement is a very broad requirement. And as a practical matter, it doesn't seem too onerous a burden to put on a prisoner to say what it is he's requesting from the prison officials. He could say, I want out of segregation, I want people punished. And in fact, this prisoner did do that in his second grievance.
But there are all kinds of relief that he can't get from the exhaustion process. And the whole point of Booth was, so what? You know, there still are valuable gains from going through this process. Disputes can be narrowed. Maybe people will drop their complaint if they get half a loaf instead of the whole loaf, whatever. I mean, there are a bunch of things the court talks about. After he's finished exhausting, he might still want money damages. He's not going to get money damages from the prison. It would be silly for him to be required to ask for them in a process that can't give them.
And I think that's correct, Your Honor, in terms of things that are not either legally available to him, but in terms of seeking to have people removed from positions, or in seeking to not be permitted, or not have this doctor be permitted to deal with him anymore, those are very legitimate issues that the prison could address to him directly. So our basic point is that the prisoner had an opportunity to seek the relief. He didn't do it, but as I've indicated, what we really think needs to happen is that Judge Murphy needs an opportunity to actually examine these facts so that he can issue a ruling, and it may make this issue moot altogether.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just a few points. To pick up on Judge Wood's point about the August grievance does sufficiently allege the conspiracy, Your Honor hit exactly the operative language, and if you drop down two more lines, he's talking about a scenario where they tried to get him to recant, he wouldn't, then they reissued him, they gave him another ticket. That is the very conspiracy that we are alleging in the amended pleading. And if there was any doubt that they have put the prison on notice, the prison board's very decision says that he is grieving the whole conduct of the staff, of people that had knowledge, and we don't think it's an appropriate grievance, so we're going to toss it out. The prison has been given the opportunity. That's what the PLRA exhaustion requirement is all about. Plaintiff now has the right to his day in federal court. As far as Your Honor's point about specificity, plaintiff agrees that the employment context is an excellent analog, and certainly a prisoner shouldn't be held to a higher standard than an employee should. And I think probably the most telling fact of all is that the only viable argument the state really has left is that the August grievance was not sufficiently particular. They don't cite a single case in support of that position. And if that's really the only thing they have left, there's no longer any reason but to hold that the August grievance was sufficient to satisfy the exhaustion requirement and in and of itself justifies reversing the grant of summary judgment. To address Dr. David's final point that we should remand, plaintiff respectfully submits that the case, you know, it's coming up on 5 years. The case has not moved forward. There has been no discovery. There hasn't even been an answer. There is sufficient grounds to reverse on the sufficiency of the August grievance, which the state defendants don't even address in their brief. The summary judgment should be reversed. Plaintiff should be allowed to go to trial, or should be allowed to proceed toward trial with discovery. And as I said, he should have his day in court. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
The court will take this case.